we've learned anything from these past couple of years, my fellow Americans, it's that personal medical freedom and liberty are in crisis. America Out Loud Pulse brings together the top experts in healthcare-related fields to keep you a beat ahead.
April is Autism Action Month, and today on America Out Loud Pulse with Dr. James Lyons-Weiler, we are going to talk with two parents who have spent the last 20 years figuring out what the NIH should have figured out, which is how to take care of kids that have severe autism. This is Francis Collins' legacy. In this segment, we're going to consider what's been going on for the past 30 years. There was a time in the history of the United States and most Western civilization, if your child was born with a neurological disorder that was a neurodevelopmental disorder, the neurodevelopment caused them to not be able to integrate into society. They were put away into a disappointment loop. And I have to say, in coming into awareness of these problems with autism through an academic route, I'm very upset. And I've been upset since 2015 when I started researching the problem of autism, because former director of the NIH, Francis Collins, sat in his position, very high-paid position, overseeing the disbursement of funds for research to all major medical and minor biomedical research projects funded by the NIH, both intramural and extramural. And not only did he not fund research aimed at improving the neurodevelopment of kids that had neurodevelopmental challenges, he also didn't fund the fact that we have to look after their health in a very specialized and individualistic manner. So today, to help me out with this topic, I've invited two guests, and they will tell you their story. And we're going to focus on the problem of the lack of science in the United States and elsewhere in caring and how to care, has best care for these kids. It all falls on the families and the specific kinds of problems that might be addressed if you get a decent administration in place that would take this problem seriously. So I want to share with you and introduce to you John Gilmore, who is the executive director of the New York chapter of Children's Health Defense, and he's also the chair of Autism Action Network. And my very close friend, Mr. Louis Conti, who works with Skyhorse Publishing, who famous for Robert F. Kennedy's The Real Anthony Fauci, of course, and my book, The Environmental and Genetic Causes of Autism. Welcome, fellas. Thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks for having us.
Absolutely. Thank you, Jack.
So John, I want to start with you. Would you tell us from your firsthand experience and on your travels, take about 5 minutes or so, and just lay out exactly what you've witnessed happen to yourself and families with kids that have these needs?
Okay, well, my story is a pretty common story. My son right now is 22 years old. And his story is that in his first year of life, he had 3 rounds of vaccines. And every time he had a round of vaccines, we saw changes in his behavior, changes in his health. And the last round, when he was about a year old, he basically had a classic autistic regression, which is a loss of skills. He had a couple words, which he lost, and he developed stereotypic autistic behavior, staring at ceiling fans, playing with toys in very strange ways. He lost a sense of pain and so on and so forth. If you talk to any parent who has a child in their 20s who regressed, it's not an unusual story. You know, we eventually got him an autism diagnosis. I diagnosed my son at the time because our pediatrician and most pediatricians at the time didn't know anything. And one day I was cleaning the basement and there was a radio program on and they were talking about autism. It turned out the host was a big NPR host here in New York who turned out to have an autistic son. They had a couple of experts on who were talking about the symptoms. And as they were talking about the symptoms, as I'm cleaning the garage, I'm going, check, 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 check. And that was just a process of finding an expert at the time, because there weren't that many physicians around that did the diagnosis. And that kind of got us into the whole early intervention, special education world. My wife's career basically ended. You know, that became caring for my son, my younger son, sort of became the central focus of our life. And one thing that this is something I say all the time, this perfectly, I think, is in sync with what you want to do tonight. But when we were first learning about autism, you know, around 2001, official science had no idea what caused it, but they thought it was genetic, most likely genetic, even though kids were developing normally and regressing, which seems to be a very strange kind of genetic characteristic. You know, there was no cure. There was no known treatment. They had no idea how many kids had autism, you know, and they weren't sure whether the rate was going up or going down or what have you. But they thought the rate is about 1 out of 500 kids. And here we are 22 years later. Okay, official science is still saying they don't know what causes autism, but they think it's genetic, most likely. However, back 22 years ago, they were looking for the autism gene, the one gene that might do it, right? And they couldn't find that gene, even though almost all the research dollars that were available were going to that. Then they thought it might be two genes. Now they couldn't find the two genes. Then it went to 5, then it went to 10, then it went to 25. And in preparation for the show, I just sort of kind of did an update on seeing what they're saying these days. And an article I found from a few months ago said they think that it's the operation of hundreds of thousands of genes. Okay. Now, what that means is that there's a bunch of guys out there making their living doing autism genetic research. It's clearly not genetic, but they're doing whatever they can to keep the gravy train going, right? And your friend Francis Collins is perfectly happy to do that because that was his field, was genetics, right? But one thing we do know is that back in 2001, they thought 1 out of 500 kids might have autism, right? Now it's generally considered to be 1 out of 40 and 1 out of 25 boys. And after 20 years, they're still saying, we can't really figure out if the autism rate is going on or not. How do you go from 1 in 500 to 1 in 40 over a span of 20 years and still be able to sustain the idea that you can't really figure out if the autism rate is going up or not?
Okay, right. So those are really super points. In my research and in my book, they had 850 genes that they prioritized as most important. And I think it's super unethical that they didn't do any environmental studies along with those genetic studies to look for genetic and environmental interactions, which is a classically known way to do studies. And I want to go to Lewis right now. And I want to say, Lewis, well, okay, we're here. We're in this problem. They saw it rising. It's been 30 years. I want to focus a little, if you don't mind, on some medical challenges and so on that could have been addressed by NIH. Really get under the hood here about the malfeasance of Dr. Francis Collins at the NIH. He held the purse strings. Why the heck didn't he do anything about it?
Well, and you know, thank you, Jack. First thing I want to say is I actually, to some degree, have a little bit of a longer distance perspective on autism. My sons are also 22. I have triplet boys, two with autism. Similar story to John's. My thing is it's two young men with autism, one functioning well, another one more impacted. But back in 1981, when I was a psychology major, I went to a program in Rockland County, New York, where they were studying people with autism and developing behavioral interventions for people with autism. And the director of that program told me at that time, and I did not have children at that time, I did not know what autism was or what it meant, that he had the only 4 people with autism in the entire Hudson Valley of New York State. So at that time, that was a population of about 1.5 million people. He was aware of 4 cases and he had them in his program. So we've now gone from the early 1980s of 4 known cases in the Hudson Valley to, I don't know what the numbers would be now, but there are 4 people with autism on my block. And in terms of getting under the hood, we have known for years that the guts of children with autism, young people with autism, are messed up. Little to no research devoted towards, frankly, even making people with autism not be in pain, right? the issues around what interventions really work for people with autism. I can't think of a single advance in this field in terms of working with people that came from the medical establishment, which is funded by Francis Collins, right? I can't think of a single advance that's come from that funding stream or from Dr. Collins's work. Who's pushed the envelope, who's made things happen, has been parents. It's been parents who've been sought out and basically sought ways to have successful interventions for their kids. It's parents who push their kids into jobs. Now I have young adults here, and my wife, just like John's wife, her career ended, same thing here. Basically, when you have a kid with autism, you know, half your family income is gone within a few years because someone has to, you know, keep an eye on, you know, the kid, preventing wandering, getting services, fighting for educational opportunities for them, all that kind of stuff. In terms of the biology of it, people with autism are the equivalent of, you know, biological train wrecks. And there's a lot that could be done if we looked at the interaction between genes and environment and toxins and the things that could be triggering them, right? But we are hesitant to do that. It is quite clear to me, 20 years into this now, that if you do something like, say, you know, it seems to me that a lot of these kids have issues shedding metals, shedding toxins, that the next question has to be, where did those heavy metals and toxins come from? And no one wants to go there, right? So Francis Collins was comfortable in letting that sit that way.
Absolutely. That's a great summary. So my deep dive into the literature certainly did point to the idea that autism is an acquired cellular detoxification deficiency syndrome. And then the gut issues that you spoke of, you know, we detoxify our body through our liver, and then the product from the liver goes into our feces. Well, it has to pass out of the body through the intestines. And so we're poisoning cells in the intestinal lining on the way out. That's the best model that I could think of. Thank you for bringing up pain management as well. The idea that you understand one autistic child because you've seen another, they can't speak for themselves. They can't tell you what hurts. They can't tell you if it hurts. They don't react the same way with the communication problems that they have.
Jack, I have a name for what is really going on around us. And I refer to it as the great poison. And that's really what I think is going on. You know, and that's what autism is a reflection of, but also many other health conditions we're seeing across the board here. Yeah, and that's how I define it, the great poison. That's what the autism epidemic is.
It's a great way to put it. This is why I created the course Environmental Toxicology that I teach once a year for 15 weeks at IPAC EDU to teach everyone where their toxins are coming from. It's not just the metals. These kids with autism, they have elevated organic pollutants of all types in their body. They have a problem getting rid of it. So I wanted to come back on another issue as well, which is the research that could have been done. There's been a small amount of research on interventions with Richard Fry trying out folinic acid and finding that folinic acid might be some of benefit. And of course, the fecal matter transplant addressing the issues with the depopulation of the microbiome. And one of those scientists wrote the foreword to my book. And in writing my book, I needed a foreword. And I asked Dr. Richard Fry to write the foreword for my book. And he said, thank you. You just reviewed all the literature for the past 15 years on autism. Now you've defined the next 5 years of my research program. I said, well, this is great. Now that you like the book, okay, now we have to let every pediatrician know. We have to let all the neurologists know, neurodevelopmental specialists know. We need to know, let everyone know. And he said, Jack, hang on. He goes, they all know. They just can't talk about it or they get their funding cut. That is the reality. And that's what we're talking about here tonight. This is Francis Collins' legacy. And it's not just the kids with frank autism either. There's a tail. They're at the severe end of it. The aluminum, the mercury, it's altered development for hundreds of millions of children across the United States for 30 years. John, what are your thoughts?
You know, it just kills me because let's compare the approach to autism and the approach to AIDS. AIDS came out of nowhere. After a couple of years, a really intense research program was started. They were spending about $3 billion a year in research on AIDS back in the 80s. The feds are still spending about $3 billion a year on AIDS. And what has happened in that time? Well, they figured out what causes AIDS, right? They came up with effective treatments. Not so good at first, but now basically if AIDS is caught early enough, it can be managed to the point where most people diagnosed with AIDS can have a normal lifespan and basically a healthy lifespan as long as they stay on their management. The mortality rate for AIDS, at least in the United States, has gone down considerably, right? I guess the average life age of someone with AIDS in the United States now is basically approaching that of the ordinary population, okay? So we've got all that stuff already, but we're still spending $3 billion a year on AIDS, okay? Now let's compare that to autism. Like I was telling you before, we don't know what causes it. We don't know have any treatments. It's clear that the lifespan of people with autism is much lower than other people, but we're only spending $300 million a year. We're spending one-tenth as much as we are on AIDS, and basically we've got much of AIDS licked at this point. So what I would say is maybe all that effort that produced so many great results with AIDS, that kind of response, it needs to be directed at autism. And maybe we'll actually get somewhere, but we got to wait for that. You know, we were talking about the sort of the GI issues. I mean, that's really, really common amongst people with autism. And, you know, I'm sure Lou has had this experience, but like managing my son's GI issues and symptoms has been, you know, an ongoing issue with us every day for 20 years. We have to carefully watch his diet, you know, other aspects of his health and so on. One of the things that has changed, like, I guess, over the last generation is that once upon a time, people like my son would probably be in a large institution of some kind, right? And the large institutions have been closed, I think most everywhere, certainly here in New York where I am. Actually, that's how Geraldo Rivera started his career. That's by revealing the sort of terrible conditions in the institutions here. But what they've been replaced by is group homes, and which in some way is a big improvement. But one thing I was looking at some statistics, and this just shocked me, is that here on Long Island where I live, one of the biggest causes of death in group homes is impacted bowels. That's basically people dying of constipation, which is one of the most pervasive symptoms amongst people with autism, and they're simply got the wrong diet and no care. And basically they're allowed to get constipated to the point that they die.
This is incredible. So listen, I want to point everyone to Skyhorse Publishing, Autism Action Network. I'm just going where the information is. So John Gilmore, Louis Conti, you are knights in shining armor for the generation of the afflicted. I really look up to you and respect you immensely. So thank you for being part of this. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Jack. Thank you for all your work.
If you're like me, you'd like life to return to some kind of normal. You're burned out on the precautions, but deep down, you still want to avoid getting sick. You've heard it talked about time and again by respected medical professionals. Use a povidone iodine antiviral nasal spray. Made in the USA, Cofix RX reduces viral loads and minimizes the risk of you getting sick. Find a retailer near you or click our banner ad on AmericaOutloud.com and use code OUTLOUD for 20% off.
Now the spirit of American liberty and justice is woven into the soul of America Out Loud. Now we invite you, friends, to invest some of your time with our magnificent family of experts, their minds and voices. It's all back at AmericaOutloud.com. Liberty and justice for all.
Along with a healthy immune system, clean air is vital for optimal health. According to the EPA, we spend 90% of our time indoors, where germs are most concentrated. It's essential to clean indoor air. Genesis is the only technology that quickly, safely, and effectively kills pathogens both in the air and on surfaces in seconds, reducing the viral load in any environment. The powerful, well-built Genesis Fogger produces a dry, ultra-fine mist using HOCL, which occurs naturally in our own immune systems. We'll be living with airborne diseases in the future. New viruses and antibiotic-resistant superbugs are no problem for Genesis. With Genesis, you'll be ready for what's next. Visit GenesisFogger.com. America Out Loud listeners receive a 15% discount with promo code OUTLOUD at genesisfogger.com/outloud.
All right, our next segment. So this week, my guest is Tia Severino. She has been doing this for quite some time to educate people in all walks of life on the perils of certain practices. Those include vaccination and taking untested medical products, such as vaccines, untested for carcinogenicity, untested for mutagenicity, untested for health in your body in any real significant way, which is why I have here today. June 3rd and 4th, 2022 in Atlanta, Georgia. Next Steps Conference is what we're going to be talking about today. The lineup is fantabulous. Tia, welcome to Pulse.
Well, hi there. Thanks for having me. You know, I love you and everything that you do. So I appreciate the opportunity to join and get my voice out there. Of course, you and I go back to 2016. We met at the Health Freedom Summit that Michelle Ford put on in April 2016. It was the first screening that I got to see of Vaxxed, From Cover Up to Catastrophe, 6 weeks before, no, 3 weeks before we opened to a 2-week sold out shows in the Atlanta Midtown Art Cinema. And I remember so very vividly the presentation that you gave where you talked about magic and in reference to the schedule of childhood immunizations and in reference to the studies that had been done to determine whether or not those routine childhood immunizations, they call them immunizations, had anything to do with autism. Because, you know, they say vaccines do not cause autism. They scream it and put it in bold letters. And anyone who dares say, oh, my kid was injured, no, vaccines do not cause autism. Well, when you actually break it down, they've only looked at one vaccine and one ingredient, you know. So they've looked at thimerosal and they've looked at the MMR. And in both cases, they found information that was in their minds deemed worthy of not being revealed to the public. And so they engaged in cover-up practices in both cases. Okay, so the science is not settled. Even when you look at the vaccines and the ingredients that they have looked at, however, there's this whole category of vaccines that haven't even been looked at, you know, most notably the ones given in the first year of life. There's a lot of question marks about those vaccines. They've not been studied. We don't have answers. And I personally, my son was injured not by the MMR. His injuries occurred from four vaccines that were given one at a time and spread out all before he was 6 months of age. So he got the Hep B, he got the Hib, he got the meningococcal, and he got the flu vaccine. And then I stopped, and he has autism. You know, I really, really shuddered to think how severe he would be had I given him that whole battery of injections that they want to give babies, you know, multiple shots, many of those shots being multivalent or, you know, the multiple antigen vaccines, like a DTaP, which is three. You know, I understand hepatitis B, even though I thought it was a single vaccine, is actually two strains of hepatitis B in there. Flu can be a trivalent or quadrivalent. Usually it's a trivalent or a quadrivalent vaccine. So four different strains, three different strains. And, you know, I just, these kids that go in and they get five, six injections and, you know, two, three, or four out of the series that they're being dosed with, they're multivalent. So sometimes these kids are getting 23 antigens all at once. And we wonder why SIDS happens, you know, at the three, you know, at the two, four, and six mark, you know, 6 months mark when we get these routine shots. So mm-hmm. I'm not sure what that was.
It's just banging on the table. That's all. It comes through pretty loud. You're upset about it, and you should be. It's absolutely a mistake to expect that those that stand to profit the most are going to be doing objective research. What we have here, people, is not just no studies done on most vaccines to show they don't cause autism, but we also have the studies that were done on the few vaccines that were studied, manipulated, and contrived to mislead the public. So, but we're not here to talk about autism per se. The Next Steps conference is actually the second of the type of conference that you have planned. And this time you asked me to help coordinate it and run it. I'll be emceeing the event. And you have this vision, which is a great vision, to talk about real science and real medicine. And I'm just a stellar lineup here. I see Del Bigtree there. I see Dr. Peter McAuliffe. I see yours truly, Mary Holland, Dr. Brian Artis, Dr. Pam Popper, Tom Renz, Dr. Henry Ely, my close friend, Ralph Hazelhurst, another parent of a vaccine injury child, the infamous and ubiquitous Robert Scott Bell. You got to tell me about some of these guys. I'm going to meet them for the first time, but Derek Brose, I know Jennifer Margulis, Dr. Shannon Proner, Pastor Patrick L. Collis, Jill Hines, there she is, I know her, Nicole Johnson Esquire, Don Richardson, the beautiful Michelle Ford, and Pastor Todd Coconato, and of course, D.S. Severino and Tim Ray are going to be pulling this all together. So when we talk about real science and real medicine, and this is in the context of next steps, what are we to do now that we have them on the run? We have the science deniers on the run. We have the vaccine manufacturers wondering how the heck they're going to pull the wool over our eyes again. It's all about education and research, and this is a brilliant format. So what's the venue? Well, you're not going to mention the venue yet. That's got to be kept secret until we get to it. But what's the size of the venue? About how many people do you expect to be in attendance?
You know, I think we're going to be able to cram up to 800 people in this spot. It is a lovely venue in the Northeast Marietta, Atlanta, Georgia area. So Marietta is a city that's a suburb of Atlanta, and we're up in the northeast corner of Marietta. There's this beautiful little spot. And I will say it's, the reason that I did Next Steps to Health Freedom back in 2017, which you spoke at, was because I saw a problem where if you could just pull a couple of cogs out of the wheel, the wheel on the whole wagon, you know, the wheel would fall off, the wagon would tumble, and everything in it would fall out. And so what I saw was that we have to get our children out of the school system, because, and it's even more clear now, 5 years later, you know, the indoctrination that's happening and CRT and social emotional learning and, you know, the sexual indoctrination, you know, sexual hypersexualization and indoctrination of our children. It's a real big problem. But I was saying back in 2017, you got to get your kids out of the school system. Okay. And also, the pediatricians, you got to get the kids away from the pediatricians, because I saw those as the two biggest, you know, pushers of the vaccine program. The school, you can't get into the school if your kid's not vaccinated. You got to jump through all these hoops, and they don't tell you that you have religious exemptions. They don't tell you that you have medical exemptions. In some states, they have philosophical exemptions. You know, they don't tell you that. And so my mind was, we've got to start building this parallel society. So it was a series of 5 workshops, a vaccine primer, which you spoke on, Get Off the Bus, which was about homeschooling and unschooling and cyber school and whatever other options besides regular public or even private schools, which are better, but, you know, in some cases they carry a lot of the same curriculum. And then we had It Takes a Village, which was about community building, and Should You Fire Your Pediatrician, which was, again, we're talking about, like, how do we start to build that parallel society? And so this time around, it's expanded out. It's 2 days. We have 7 workshops. You mentioned the speakers. I'll just go really quickly over the different workshops. So Friday morning, we'll start out with legislative action. That's Don Richardson, Jill Hines, and Nicole Johnson. They're going to be talking about, how do you approach your legislators? How do you find out who your legislators are? Form relationships with them, support good bills, fight bad bills. Then we have Legal Update with Mary Holland, Rolf Hazelhurst, Tom Srenz. They're going to be basically getting us up to speed on what's happening now in the legal world around all the stuff we're talking about. Then we have Community Building with Michelle Ford and Derek Bros. Michelle, sorry, Wake Up the Church comes first. Yeah, that's right. Wake Up the Church with Dr. Shannon Croner, and she's bringing two pastors from her organization, Freedom of Religion United Solutions, and they're going to be talking about how to approach your faith leader to, you know, get them on board with protecting religious freedom, because if we don't have the churches standing up for our religious exemptions, like, we have no chance at all. Then we have, and also, how do you justify your religious exemption based on your, you know, spiritual texts? So a lot of people, when they get pushed for that, well, where does it say in the Bible or whatever religious text that you shouldn't do this? Okay, so they're going to help with that. Community Building is Michelle Ford and Derek Bros. You know Michelle. Michelle has the Vaccine Injury Awareness League out in California, and she's been an amazing advocate educating people about vaccine injuries. She's going to be talking, though, about something different during the workshop. She's going to be talking about how you can opt out of the current system of being a ward of the, a bond, sorry, of the corporation of the United States. You know, when we're born, we have a birth certificate that's issued to us. We become basically a bond. We're a human resource. They are borrowing, you know, money against us. Literally, they own us. So how do you opt out of that whole system? And so that's a very fascinating subject. And it, Derek Bros is a journalist, activist, filmmaker. He's written a trilogy of books called The Conscious Resistance. And he has a series out right now that he's doing, a docuseries called The Pyramid of Power, which you can see at thepyramidofpower.net. And by the way, all the speakers and all the information about each of the speakers and their websites can be found on next-steps.info. So when you go there, everybody's websites are linked in the speaker bios for the individual workshops. We have a VIP, I should say, with the Community Building Group workshop, we also have several groups that are here in Georgia that are fighting for freedom, and each of their representatives will be able to speak for a few minutes. Then we have a VIP dinner, and that wraps up Friday, which is whirlwind. I should say we've got speakers and live music at the VIP dinner. It's going to be amazing. Gourmet food, allergy friendly.
Is it going to be karaoke or no?
The karaoke will be Saturday night.
Saturday night,
after we're done with everything, there will be some karaoke at the VIP party, which is exclusive invite only. Okay. So Saturday morning, we have the Real Science workshop and the Real Medicine workshop. So those are the two that you're moderating. Okay. So technically you're not emceeing the whole show. You're just moderating those two workshops.
I'll do what I can do for you. Bookends,
Real Science. You're going to be talking with Dr. Pam Popper and Dr. Henry Ely, looking at what went wrong with COVID science, the fraud. How do you determine real science from propaganda? And then real medicine. We have Dr. Brian Artis, Dr. Peter McCullough, and I guess I'm announcing here that Dr. Christiane Northrup is going to be joining that panel. We lost one of our speakers. Not going to go into details on that. These things just happen. Sometimes people can't make it. So we've found somebody amazing to take the place of Dr. Corey, and Dr. Christiane Northrup will be joining, and they'll be talking about what went wrong with standard of care when it comes to treating COVID. And, you know, this goes back, there's a history of standard of care protocols preceding COVID that have been killing patients. And how can you actually, what are good effective alternative, what they call them alternative, but effective treatments for COVID? How can you get those? How can you actually take care of yourself so you aren't living in this this panic, fear-based kind of existence they've had a lot of people living in for the last 2 years? Okay,
great. So that sounds like a fantastic event, and I'm very much looking forward to it. All of your events are excellent. I've been to a number of them and participated. So, you know, it's an honor to help you out, and I'd be more than happy to MC Real Science and Real Medicine on Saturday. I'm mostly looking forward to the karaoke, because these are all my friends. We're all coming together, share some time. You know, we're going to actually hug each other unmasked. This is, risky behavior these days. So are there any details about signing up that you want to share with the listeners of America Out Loud Pulse?
Well, I do want to say that you don't want to miss Saturday afternoon, because that's Robert Scott Bell, Jennifer Margulis, and Del Bigtree with Shifting the Paradigm. and the launch of the UI Media Awards. We're going to be recognizing journalistic excellence in the truth media. The main reason why you want to get to this event, though, is something that you just said a minute ago, which is that it's going to be a life-changing event. You know, we've all been locked up for 2 years. There's been a few events that have been happening here and there, but people are really hungry for this. They're really hungry to get together and not just watch videos of people on their computers or their phones at home. I mean, really get in there and get the atmosphere and get the hugs and get the phone numbers and get the selfies and all that great stuff. Because, you know, this is exactly what we want to be doing, is talking about how can we move forward and what are the next steps. And that's another thing too, is that each speaker is supposed to bring three next steps. So you should be thinking about, what are your three next steps? And how do you find out more about the event? How do you get the tickets? Go to next-steps.info. And all the information is there, where to stay, where your hotels, you know, what to expect as far as food, what the sponsors are, all that good stuff is on the website.
Great. Fantastic. All right. Well, listen, my friends and family and others who are out there, do not miss this conference. I wouldn't miss it for my life. So I want to thank you, Tia, for being part of this experiment on America Out Loud Pulse, and we'll have you back again and again.
I love you, so anytime you want to have me on, you're on.
I want to put in a big word for healthy cell supplements. The GI tract is not functioning normally in long COVID syndrome. I'm convinced of it. There are multiple studies. We need a much better absorbed set of nutraceutical and vitamin products for long COVID syndrome, and that's Healthy Cell. They have an entire line that's safe and effective, can help people through the long COVID syndrome. I found the best way to use Healthy Cell products is use them every day, not on and off, on and off. Take them every day consistently. The Immune Super Boost, Focus and Memory, and the REM Sleep Supplement all have powerful effects in long COVID syndrome. Go to HealthyCell.com and in the promo code, type in Out Loud for 20% off your first order. Let's get real. Let's get loud on America Out Loud Talk Radio.
Because of COVID-19, many Americans worry about their health four times a day. That's 112 times per month. But by simply keeping our immune system strong, we can stay healthy and put our worries at ease. One little known way to do this is by taking AC11, a patented supplement from a plant in the Amazon rainforest. Studied for over 20 years and backed by over 40 scientific peer-reviewed studies, taking AC11 has been proven to extend the life of immune cells called leukocytes, allowing you to boost immunity naturally. Go to HealthyCell.com and use code OUTLOUD for 20% off your first order of AC11. That's HealthyCell.com, HealthyCell, and use code OUTLOUD for 20% off.
All right, so the next topic on this particular episode of America Out Loud Pulse is about what's happened to the American Constitution, what's happened to our personal rights and liberties, specifically from a historic standpoint, with the fundamentals of what our forefathers and our founding fathers and their wives put into the documents that we revere in these United States of America. And so to help me do that, I'm very pleased to bring in the Professor Rob Rigney, who's an instructor at IPAC EDU. And we're going to talk about the deep history of the origins of rights and liberties and the history of the West for a little bit. And then we're going to go into historic and current threats to the US Constitution. Those are two broad areas. Rob Rigney, how are you doing?
Oh, pretty good. Pretty good. Glad to be here.
Good. So my first question is, people believe our founding fathers, they often imagine our founding fathers were imbued with some wisdom that came from nowhere in terms of, you know, a balance of individual rights and collective rights. And the deal that was brokered that became, you know, in the documents, the founding documents, including the starting with the Declaration of Independence and drafts thereof before, but also the documents that were drafted to build up to the U.S. Constitution. Could you tell us a little bit about some of the deep history, the things that stick out in your mind as the most profound contributions from people from hundreds or thousands of years before 1776?
Well, the one thing that I always try to emphasize in when teaching a course about the history of the of rights and liberties, you know, the Constitution, anything like that, I always try to emphasize to the students is the importance of understanding that the Founding Fathers were students of history. They were very highly educated men. In their time, and even today by our standards of education, they were voracious readers, and they were students of the past. And what I mean by that is, if you look at the Constitution and many of the ideas within the Constitution, they come from Athenian and Greek history of constitutions that the Athenians and the Spartans, same with the Romans. But those constitutions were built on ideas from the Egyptians. And there was always what I call a progression of acknowledgement of people and rights. And if you look at historically the idea of the Code of Hammurabi of the Babylonians, if you look at that in the historic context of kind of, and the way I like to illustrate it is you're standing in Independence Hall in May of 1787, looking backwards. The Code of Hammurabi describes to the society around it, these are the rules that if you're going to be in this community, these are the rules and duties you have. Now, they didn't acknowledge rights, but they were acknowledging that the duty of the person to the city, the state, the king, you had certain duties, and these duties were your types of behaviors. They have in there the idea of contracts and weights and measures within the Code of Hammurabi. And those are right in our Constitution. If you look at Article 1, Section 8, there's a talk about how the Congress will set weights and measures, how they will establish courts for contracts. And so it wasn't this you know, ingenious thing. They were students of history. And that's one of the things that, you know, I always try to, when teaching about law and rights, is drawing that line to the past, to the present. And then if you look at, you know, 1787, if you prefer, the idea of the Bill of Rights. And it's basically the contract of showing here's the role of government, here's the role of the citizen, these are your rights. And it's just a build upon that basic idea that was started with the Code of Hammurabi way back, you know, in the Babylonian era. And that's one of the first codes of law that we can actually point to and say, there's law.
Absolutely. So Thomas Jefferson especially was a student of history, and he studied cultures other than the governments that were in place in Europe and West. He also studied Middle Eastern cultures and was very aware of Muhammad law, the Islamic law. And so when we're looking at what we now enjoy in terms of individual rights and liberties, and then states' rights and federal powers. Take us a little bit through the negotiations that had to take place between people that held and still hold very fervent and passionate views about the relative balance between those three entities, individual states, and federal government.
One of the things that I kind of talk about when looking at this kind of stuff, there is a story that comes from Egypt, and you can find it on the internet. It's out there, and it's called The Story of the Eloquent Peasant. And it is the first story that they don't actually call them a lawyer, but the story of the eloquent peasant is he was a peasant, he was aware of Egyptian law, and he made an argument in their form of courts that they had in Egypt, this settling the dispute. And it shows the, you know, the role of the individual to the state. And, you know, in Egypt, you have the king, and then you have the religion, and you had all those things, kind of almost a combination of things. But that's kind of one of the first places I say, look, here's what you have of where it kind of begins. And it begins, you know, way back in the ancient Egyptian times. And those arguments and discussions, you go to Aristotle, to Plato, to Lycurgus, the Spartan king who wrote the Spartan constitution, you know, the roles, the rights, the duties of the person to the state. And all of these things are discussed quite heavily. And one of the things that I tell students is that there is a, it's like a pendulum effect. Yes, you might move towards a very strict state where there's very strict, you know, very limited, you know, liberties and things like that, but then it will also swing back in the opposite direction. If you look at Sparta, very strict society. Athens, a very open society. Rome kind of takes a combination of the two because they had to acknowledge the empire, the other cultures and other groups within the empire who weren't Roman citizens. They had to be acknowledged as well. But then you had Roman citizens and Roman, you know, nobles, and you had all these things. And each time in society, you can look at different changes. Then you can get into the Middle Ages, the early Middle Ages. Augustinian was a very early, St. Augustine was a very early Catholic writer, and he discusses, you know, your duties. But when you begin to have the early Middle Ages, the church is the center of the political power because they back the kings. And, you know, so you have this evolution. And then when you get to, you know, the American Revolution, you have the beginnings of what we have today, which has evolved over time. And there's always a build upon, but you might have a shift back to more of a, what I call a centralized state. And then you might have the pendulum swing back to the more, you know, decentralized state with, you know, much more liberties. It just depends on the time period you're looking at. And this is one of the things that I try to emphasize is that, you know, the Middle Ages, the church had all the power. You get to the more modern age and the secular age, you know, at, you know, the time of the Enlightenment of the 1700s, you have a shift away from that. And that's one of the things that you have to really kind of look at and understand, because the fathers of our Constitution, they were all aware of these things. They were all hot, you know, and one of the things that, you know, I try to emphasize in those days, the more books you had, the kind of the wealthier you were seen, because books were very expensive in those days. And so to have these books, you know, you would have long winters, and, you know, Jefferson and the other founding fathers had read a lot. You know, they all read a lot. They all spoke Greek and or were able to write Greek and Latin. And that's, you know, one of the things that, you know, fascinating about it is that they were all of it. The American Constitution is, I kind of almost say it's like, kind of in a humorous way, you look at the television series Star Trek with William Shatner. Well, the newer version is a retread of that with the movies, and it's a different Captain Kirk and a different, you know, Spock. But it's like that with the Constitution. It's a retread. It's been, we've seen this before. And each time, what each new group does with the new Constitution, when they develop these Constitutions, is they try to improve on the last version of that. And that's kind of one of the things I kind of, you know, kind of a long-winded answer, but that's one of the things I really try to emphasize. If you're going to look at anything political, you've got to be a student of history at the same time.
Absolutely. So in these era where individual rights are being trampled, the founding fathers had a great deal of vision in striking that balance between, you know, the state's rights, individual rights, and the power of the Fed, the federal government. And what we're looking at now is incursions and limitations of state rights, as well as limitations of individual liberties and rights. So what are some of the historic and current threats to the U.S. constitutions that come to mind most frequently to you?
Well, one of the things that kind of that I kind of point to, and it's kind of a stretch, but if you look at the time after the French and Indian Wars of 1765, what England was left with, and, you know, the British government was left with huge war debts and an empire, you know, a lot of historians would argue, I think the English kind of walked into their empire at that time period very reluctantly. And the reason was that there were a lot of other things going on in Europe, and, you know, with the Industrial Revolution and the changing of politics and things like that, and that the English realized, we've got this empire, we've got to organize it and administrate it. And one of the things I point to is how, after the wars are over, Britain is left to have to come over and deploy troops to the frontiers. However, they keep a good chunk of the troops in the cities like New York and Boston, in which the colonists thought they were going to head out to the forts like Fort Ticonderoga and, you know, little forts like on the Great Lakes, like this little fort called Detroit. And when that happened, the colonists were saying, wait a second, England. You're bringing these troops in and you're changing the rules of how we have been living here for 150 years. All of a sudden, it was an overnight thing. So when you look at the trampling of rights today, in our time period, you can draw the analogy that a lot of people are becoming very annoyed at how they're being told they can live or not live, interfering with their livelihood. If you don't take a vaccine, you're going to lose your job. Same thing as the British come in with the Stamp Act, the Intolerable Acts, the Sugar Act, the Navigation Act. They were changing the rules of the game with the colonists. And it wasn't like laws, you know, these laws were passed in Parliament, and the argument was in taxation without representation. They were screaming, hey, wait a minute. Those politicians in England, I didn't vote for them. You know, if you were in New York or Pennsylvania, the politicians that, you know, I voted for are here. They're not in London, they're here in New York City. They're here in Albany. They're here in, you know, Springfield, Massachusetts. They're not back in England. Okay, that's point one. Now just keep that on the table for a minute. With the Navigation Acts, the British were now beginning to enforce on how you can conduct trade and business. Think of the shutdowns.
Yeah, absolutely. So when we're looking at these challenges now, Rob, we only have a couple minutes left.
Yeah.
You know, people should become educated specifically about the individual threats that happened in the past, right? So that they can then, they're better able to anticipate the moves of those that would infringe on our rights now. And so, you know, what I want to emphasize is that Rob is an instructor at IPAC-EDU, and he teaches two courses. The first course is History of Law and Rights in the West, and that runs in the fall semester. And then this summer, he's actually teaching a course on constitutional law with a focus on the historic and current crises about the U.S. Constitution, the threats to the individual rights and the constitutions. And I've asked him to focus on the balancing act between individual rights, states' rights, and federal overreach. So in the last minute or so, what do you have to say?
Well, you know, one of the things that if you look at, like, for example, some of the issues that have been connected with people out in the January 6th, you know, events that happened at the Capitol. These people have had no due process. A lot of them have lost their jobs, have had their banks seized, things like that. If you look at the Quebec Act, which gave a big chunk of the Ohio Valley to the French Canadians, well, colonists were promised those properties. They were promised those livelihoods. And the government all of a sudden just turned around, took it all away from them with no due process, violating all kinds of British rights. The same thing you see happening here. It's a different song, but it's the same dance.
I love it, because what they've done is they've commoditized our health, they've commoditized our rights to choose any number of things, from what we put into our bodies to how we educate our children. Professor Robert Rigney, thank you so much for educating the public through ipac-edu.org. You guys can sign up right now. The course is open for registration, and go get your brain on. Thanks so much, Rob.
Sure thing.